This is music from Darcy James Argyer. Welcome to The Checkout, a show and a podcast from WBGO. I'm Josh Jackson. Darcy James Argyer was born in British Columbia, and now he lives in Brooklyn, New York, the city that captured his imagination in Brooklyn Babylon, his epic jazz suite for 18 musicians. Saxophonist Michael Blake listened to Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young when he grew up in Canada. He pays homage to those American masters in our performance studio. But first, an instrumental band from the so-called City of Glass that breaks all the rules, pugs and crows. Pianist Kat Torin speaks with WBGO's Kyle Eagle. It's Vancouver, BC, in NYC, on this edition of The Checkout. Thanks for checking in.
This is music from Pugs and Crows. You may never have heard of this collective of jazz and classically trained musicians because they are from Vancouver, Canada. They are Juno Award winners. That's the highest honor that can be bestowed for any musician there, kind of like receiving a Canadian Grammy. When I first heard this group, I was amazed by their dynamism. I spoke to Kat Torin, the pianist from Pugs and Crows, about their Juno Award-winning album, Fantastic Pictures, and more.
Pugs and Crows. Interesting name for a band. What's the story behind that name?
Probably because we're from Vancouver, there are definitely a lot of crows there. Which, like, they like to dive bomb us during their mating season. It's very intense. And I think Cole's grandma has a pug, and then I guess he just thought it sounded cool together.
And Cole is?
Cole's the guitarist and the main songwriter.
All right, so who are the other members of the band?
Cole Schmidt, he plays guitar. On bass is Russell Schulberg. Meredith Bates on the violin, Ben Brown on the drums, and then I play piano.
Going through some of these songs are quite interesting. Describe this music, also describe some of the song titles.
Well, some of the song titles are written in reference to the players that they feature. So, for example, Sloppy Slaughter. Well, at first I thought, because, you know, Cole's a vegetarian, so am I. I thought it was about slaughterhouses. But in actual fact, it's about Tony Wilson. So Tony Wilson is a guitarist also from Vancouver who now lives on a little island on the coast. He is kind of an honorary member in our band right now. We've been writing a record for a 6-piece ensemble with him on guitar. Yeah, so Sloppy Slaughter is in reference to the way that Tony Wilson plays guitar, especially his solos, because they just seem to go on and reach all these peaks and are fast and furious, but they're pretty sloppy, I think, in the best sense. So he's really slaughtering that.
Thank you.
That's Sloppy Slaughter by Pugs and Crows, featuring Tony Wilson on The Checkout. I'm Kyle Eagle, continuing my conversation with Kat Torn, the pianist in the band.
Now, going back to Canada, like, you're from Vancouver. That's an interesting town that's had, the past several years, many interesting personalities in the jazz idiom to come up. Michael Blake, Darcy James Argue, Diana Krall. Describe the scene in Vancouver. Like, what's in the water there to bring in all this great music out?
I definitely agree. There's so much good music coming from there. It's a pretty artsy city in general. I think it has been for quite a few generations. There's a great music school or a couple great ones there. I don't know. I feel like the people in Vancouver are very dedicated to the scene. It's not very big, but it's got a lot of talent. And I guess it's another grassroots type thing because a lot of the bigger venues, they're either shutting down or there's been a lot of little art spaces opening up lately, and a lot of collaborations, dance and music, video and music, and I think we just all love our scene so much that we put a lot of our own effort into it to make it grow.
Do you think you getting a Juno, the band getting a Juno, has anything to do with like the mindset of the Canadian music industry or music listening public?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely do. I can't think of an artist that is as outside as we are winning a Grammy, just off the top of my head anyways. We won Instrumental Album of the Year, and to be perfectly honest, I think that's all the bands I don't know where to put. You know, it's like, we're not rock, we're not pop, we're not jazz, so we don't sing. So there you are. I was really proud to be Canadian at that moment, actually.
And another track that I think stands out on the earlier record, first record, We Must Befriend the Ice Queen. What's the story behind that title?
So that song features the violin, Miss Meredith Bates, and sometimes we like to call her the Ice Queen because she calls herself the diva of the band. So enough said about that, I guess.
Thank you.
We Must Befriend the Ice Queen by Pugs and Crows from Fantastic Pictures. Kat Torin spoke with our guest contributor, Kyle Eagle. Up next, the Vancouver-born saxophonist Michael Blake performs in our Newark studio with WBGO's Michael Bourne. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson.
Music from Contrast and Individualism. We're going to talk about that because Michael Blake and Ben Allison and Farag Nemeth are here. They're going to kick it off going for a skinny dip. Skinny Dip. Michael Blake on the tenor sax, Ben Allison on the bass, Ferenc Nemeth playing drums. Tell us about Contrast and Individualism.
The full name of the work is Contrast and Individualism, Reinterpreting the Innovations of Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young. And essentially, I wanted to write music that was inspired by two masters and real innovators of this art form, and also pretty impressive human beings coming out of a very difficult period in U.S. history in terms of segregation and being pioneer artists that were able in their own time to create really interesting and amazing improvised music, and then also influence a number of generations after that.
Coleman Hawkins, for whom Adolph Sax invented the horn, said John Hendricks, because nobody was playing the tenor sax back then.
Yeah, no one was playing like that, and it's really interesting. I was a big Hawkins fan growing up and getting into jazz, and I started on the tenor when I was about 16. I had played clarinet before that, and there was a great reunion album of Pee Wee Russell and Coleman Hawkins that my father had recommended I get, and it's a fantastic album. It was on Candid, called Jazz Reunion, and that was the first time I heard him, and I was really actually emotionally affected by what he was playing before I really kind of knew much about the tenor saxophone or about him. His emotive playing on that album really, really knocked me out and stayed with me and influenced a lot of my early albums. And then in this project, I kind of took advantage of having the opportunity to write this music and do some research, and I got completely obsessed with Lester Young through that process and listening to a lot of new recordings I hadn't heard. And that was I knew a fair amount about him, but there was a wealth of new inspiration that came out of several of his solos, particularly his earliest solos.
You can hear Coleman Hawkins or Lester Young as you listen to tenor players. You can hear which one they listen to the most and their influence, and yet they're both completely different in many ways. Hawkins is hot and Lester is cool. I mean, it's always the way it sounds like. Yeah. It's almost like they breathe differently.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
Like when you're playing this music, when you're inspired, you're composing these pieces that are inspired by these two individuals, how does that affect your actual playing? Do you breathe differently?
Well, that's a really good point, which is that I think that the way that they breathe and execute their ideas, like, for example, Coleman Hawkins will often really play his lines through the amount of air that he has taken in. So the musical idea is quite closely connected to how much air he's putting through. Lester Young he's very mysterious. His lines begin and end in these places that you kind of don't expect, and they go on longer than they go over bar lines, and it's very, very sophisticated phrasing. Not that Hawkins isn't playing sophisticated, but that quality people think of as Lester Young as being lighter. But when I was really exploring the sound, it's actually, he had quite a big sound, and it's actually got a lot of girth to it.
You're going to play something from your project that's called Good Day for Prez.
Exactly. It'd be great. Thank you.
A good day for Prez. Michael Blake on the tenor sax and Ben Allison on the bass and Barak Nemeth on the drums. Your music is very smileable. There's a happiness to it.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be playing music. I feel very privileged to get to be a musician and have a career playing music. You know, there's a long period there where you're learning. and absorbing, and then you try to put it to work. And when you have a community of people around you, you really get to, you know, to have a chance to redeem myself, I feel.
This next piece we're going to hear is actually from your album, In the Grand Scheme of Things,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
And that's from your musical travels.
Yeah, it was the album was definitely inspired by a trip I took to Zambia. For my brother got married there. He lives in London, and his wife lives in London, and she's from Zambia. So we went to a wedding in Lusaka, and I brought my son with me. Our mom came out from Vancouver, so I was taking care of my son, my mom, and my brother's daughter a lot of the time, and just making sure they didn't get eaten by alligators or run over by elephants, or you know, drank the wrong water.
All those things you fear when you go around the world, and then you get surprises.
Yeah, yeah. I actually almost did get crushed by an elephant in Zambia. And I was just, you know, it was after a couple gin and tonics, and I have to admit, I was really glad I had had those right before that incident.
Was it pink?
You know, I'm happy to say it didn't fly or was big. It was just a big... I'd never seen an animal so large that close. And then the cab driver drove between the mother elephant and the calf, like through it on a dirt.
And that's then, a mistake. Yeah. Even I know that, yeah. Having never been there still. You don't drive between mom and the kid. Well, this tune is inspired by the road. Is this a road with elephants on it?
Yeah, this is. My first impression of driving into Lusaka from the airport, first time in Africa, and I wanted to capture that. And it's with a great group of Vancouver musicians, this particular band called the Variety Hour.
Road to Lusaka, music by Michael Blake from his album In the Grand Scheme of Things. The saxophonist talked with WBGO's Michael Bourne. In a minute, the British Columbia-born composer Darcy James Argue speaks to our producer Simon Rentner about his vision of Brooklyn, New York in the suite Brooklyn, Babylon. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson.
Darcy James Argue, thank you for joining us on The Checkout. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Simon.
Brooklyn Babylon is the recording. You're born in Vancouver. What is a Canadian guy dreaming up this epic jazz opera surrounded around Brooklyn?
Well, it's interesting. My co-creator for the multimedia incarnation of Brooklyn Babylon is a brilliant visual artist named Daniel Gigelia, and he's from a much more exotic place than Vancouver. Maybe he's from Zagreb. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, we both had ideas in our mind of, you know, like Brooklyn is such a mythical city, really. Like, it's been so prominent in literature and film and just popular culture generally that everyone's got an idea of, like, what it's going to be like and what it represents to them from afar. And so I think we both brought kind of an outsider's perspective on Brooklyn, and that's sort of what we wanted to capture in this piece, the kind of Brooklyn of the imagination, and kind of have all of those ideas of this kind of like city of immigrants, this sort of city of the old world in a lot of ways, and that combination of old and new coexisting. You know, I think all of those things were rattling around in our heads as we were constructing this piece and talking about what direction we would go in it.
Darcy James Argue has a band he calls Secret Society that's actually not so secretive anymore. You were nominated for a Grammy Award. You were nominated for a Juno Award. Is that at odds with each other now that you have a band that's not so secretive, but you're still calling it Secret Society?
Yeah, well, I think all of the best secret societies have you know, pretty good PR, you know, like they're part of the public imagination. That's sort of the point, is like you want, if you're the Illuminati or the Freemasons or whatever, you want people to know that you're out there and pulling all the strings. We've been really lucky with the kind of tour that we were able to put together. You know, it's so difficult these days, even just to tour with a duo, and so to be able to do it with 18 other musicians and a sound tech is really extraordinary. And I just feel so lucky that there have been presenters who are willing to take a chance on this crazy big band thing that I've put together.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of this crazy big band thing. This is Coney Island. from Brooklyn, Babylon. Joins us on the checkout. I'm Simon Redner. Another trait of this contemporary 18 piece of madness, of big band, it reminds me of what Alarm Will Sound is doing, because there's kind of this interdisciplinary nature with all of the members, even in the ensemble. On this recording, I'm hearing piccolos, I'm hearing electric guitars besides the brass, but all kinds of clarinets. I think there's a French horn in there. No French horn.
Yeah, okay. Euphonium, though.
A euphonium. Yeah. Is that part of the requirement? If you want to be in your band, you got to know five instruments.
Definitely for the wind section, it's sort of... it looks a little bit like a used instrument store in the front line. You've got like the piccolo and then the alto flute and the contrabass clarinet and all of those things. But it's one of these things. It's one of the great benefits of being in New York is that saxophonists here, a lot of them double at an incredibly high level because there's demand for it, and there's the opportunity to sub in Broadway or work on Broadway, and so often they're playing a lot of different instruments there. But you've even got saxophonists who play amazing double reeds, you know, oboe, English horn, bassoon, and that I don't think happens anywhere else. So that's a real, I guess, perk of being here and having access to players like Sam Sadagursky and Erica von Kleist, who play clarinet and flute as well as they play saxophone, and it just allows for an expansive range of colors and to also, you know, sort of literally just range of notes, of just being able to have like the piccolo way up at the top, you know, above where lead trumpet can normally play, and then the contrabass clarinet like way down at the bottom, far below where a bass trombone could go. You know, having that spread, I think was a big part of the vision for the record, of representing that sprawl. I mean, it's really the story of the tallest tower in the world, and so if I was going to sonically represent that, you know, we had to have, you know, those piercing highs and sub-basement lows as part of the arsenal.
Well, let's listen to a little Erika von Kleist on soprano saxophone with The Tallest Tower in the World. Darcy James Argue joins us on The Checkout. What is the tallest tower in the world? And I think that needs a little explanation here.
So there's a narrative attached to the album, because it's the music from this multimedia performance, which was this work that Daniel Gigel and I co-created for BAM. And it was a live performance featuring live music, live painting, and animation. And the projected animation tells this story that Daniel came up with, sort of an urban fable about a master carpenter, Lev Bezdomny, who lives in Brooklyn with his 8-year-old granddaughter. And one day he is summoned by the mayor of Brooklyn, and the mayor sort of takes him into his palace and reveals his plan to construct the tallest tower in the world, which is going to be 1,000 meters tall, which is over 3,000 feet.
We like round numbers.
Yes. And it's going to, you know, it's going to be this epic, sprawling, spiraling structure. And then at the very top of it, there's going to be this rooftop veranda, basically, and he would like to crown the building with a carousel, one of Lev's carousels. And so Lev at first is very honored to have this commission, but then as ground is cleared and domain is seized for the construction of the tower, he then has to grapple with the changes that the sort of sweeping changes that the construction of this tower represents, and people being forced out of their homes, and sort of the face of the neighborhood changing drastically. And so he's got to wrestle with his complicity in this massive construction project that is clearly set out to reward the mayor and his rich cronies.
And so this tower is twice the size of the Empire State Building, or what are we looking at? What are the ramifications of this building?
Yeah, it is enormous. It'll be over twice the size of One World Trade Center, which is 1776 feet.
Darcy James Argue. He has a recording called Brooklyn Babylon. He also has an 18-piece big band called Secret Society. Not only is he a composer, but quite the opinion writer, also making cultural commentaries on his blog at secretsocietymusic.org. In fact, I saw a post that had to do with Spotify, which is oh so prevalent on the music scene today, an article that pertains to Sleepify, is that the name of the album that was released?
So there was a band called Wolfpack, I believe, if I'm remembering that correctly. But they figured out a way to essentially game Spotify's system. Spotify is one of those great examples of an organization where the CEO is one of the richest men in the music industry right now, and yet the artists are getting fractions of a penny in streaming royalties, and it really threatens to upend the entire business from an artist's perspective, from the ability of an artist to make a living or even just to break even on recording, which is a very expensive proposition, especially with an 18-piece big band. And you can't really blame consumers for wanting to use a service like Spotify, because it's, from a user's perspective, it's great. It's like the infinite music library. But what's underpinning all of that is the real exploitation of the artists whose works are being used to build that library. And so this band, Wolfpack, figured out a way basically to get even with Spotify. And they recorded an album of silent tracks, of 30-second silent tracks that they suggested that all of their fans stream overnight on infinite loop. And then they would get those fractions of a cent per play, but they didn't have to spend any money recording the album. It's just digital silence. I think they started it as a bit of a lark, not really expecting much to come of it. But because the idea was cheeky and resonated with people, they ended up making about $20,000 this way, which is more than Lady Gaga makes for some of her hit songs on Spotify, because the royalty rates are so low. But somehow they had all of these people coming together to stream this album of silence overnight for I forget how long the run was. I think several months of this until Spotify finally put the kibosh on it and removed it from their digital library. But I think it's sort of a really creative example of artists figuring out how to game the system for themselves. Of course, it's not a long-term solution. As I mentioned, Spotify eventually pulled the plug on it, and I really hope that we need to figure out a way to get music in the hands of listeners in the 21st century in a format that makes sense for them, like in a way that they like and is easy for them, but also results in artists being able to make a living doing this and doesn't result in only the biggest superstars being able to make records anymore. And that's more and more the direction things seem to be headed in. And so I think, you know, these technologies, they're always double-edged swords. On the one hand, it is such an incredible breakthrough to have instant, you know, if I were a 13-year-old kid today, you know, I'd freak out over Spotify. I mean, that would be just the greatest thing. And I'm thinking back to, like, you know, my childhood of, you know, trudging to the record store and buying the cassette to put in my Walkman, and I could afford maybe like one tape every couple of months or so, and you'd wear that out. So like the difference in musical information that is available to people who are, especially like kids who are trying to learn to play an instrument and develop a sense of musical history and you know, learn the jazz language, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's so much easier now. But there's this double-edged sword of like, well, it comes at a cost, and the cost is musical diversity, and the cost is basic fairness to the musicians who really toil and sweat to make these records a reality.
You can check out Darcy James Argue when you go to his website at secretsociety.org. That's where you can read more screeds from Darcy James Argue about the music industry and much more. Our producer Simon Rentner spoke with a composer and conductor. The Checkout is a podcast. Get it on the go. Go to iTunes and download it on your mobile device. While you're there, you can buy a lot of this music and support artists. How about that? Including Darcy James Argue and Brooklyn Babylon. All of our shows are also on our website at checkoutjazz.org. We're on Twitter at checkoutjazz. Our producer Simon Rentner is too, at Simon Rentner. Special thanks to Tim Wilkins and production intern Joyce Kwan. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Josh Jackson. Thanks for listening.